three dead boys. It was not grass she had touched, but hair. Adisla offered a prayer to Freya. She was almost glad of the dark now and shrank back against a wall. She waited for Felek to come, holding her knees into herself for the small comfort she could take from hugging something. But Felek didn't appear. She had thought her example would encourage him. Had she been wrong? She forced herself to listen to her breathing to make sure time was really passing, that the eternity she felt was in reality no more than a few heartbeats. Felek still did not come. She tried to think what to do. Return to the surface, she decided. Adisla felt for the rope and prepared herself for the haul back. It would be easier, she told herself. She knew how long the tunnel was. She took the rope in her hands and tested it. Yes, it was secured at the other end. She could pull herself through. Then she thought of Vali, enchanted and forsaken in that pit. If Felek was incapable of coming through the tunnel, there was no guarantee another entrance to the witch caves could be found. A terrible thought struck her. What if Felek had drowned in the tunnel? Would she find his body blocking her way? Trembling and terrified, she forced herself to think. This was the Troll Wall, and the witches had been the death of countless heroes. Who was to say that Felek would be any different? For Vali's sake, she had to go on without him. Adisla steeled herself and searched the boys' bodies, hoping to find a lamp. She found only the amulets at their necks. She took one. It had done the child no good, but who was to say it wouldn't help her? Crawling past the boys, she cut her knees on the floor. Never mind, she was going to have to get used to that. When she was sure the corpses were behind her, she struck the flint again. In the brief flash, she saw the passage going on and down, and went ahead before striking once more to check her way. She didn't expect to see anything much, but thought she might at least get some warnings of drops, low ceilings, or falls. Nevertheless, she proceeded cautiously, feeling her way forward. It was painful progress, and it was slow. She hoped she would find Felek again. He had told her that he had a great treasure in the hills. Felek was naive and didn't have the guile to lie about something like that. If he said he had treasure, he had treasure. It would be something she could use to bargain with the witches to get them to use their magic to bring Vali back to human form. She could offer her word she would deliver it. But what was the word of a woman? Perhaps Felek would have been useful. They would more readily accept the oath of a warrior. She tried to smother her deeper thoughts. For as long as she could remember, she had loved only Vali. Now she was terrified of him, and Felek, with his honesty and kindness, offered her the chance of a simple life away from the affairs of kings and sorcerers. Adisla's love for Vali had devoured her, Felek, her mother, everything it touched. But for that love, the Danes would never have come for her, and her mother would still be alive. Little Mani, too. She couldn't abandon the prince, though, no matter what. Questions of the heart were for the sunshine and the open air. In the tunnels of the Troll Wall, she had more pressing concerns. Adisla had never known such dark. It seemed like a beast smothering her, her flint a little thorn that she jabbed into its belly, forcing a momentary retreat before its dead weight came down on her again. How would she call a witch? What would she say? Adisla didn't know. First, she thought, she needed light. There was plenty of detritus on the tunnel floors. Surely she would come across a lamp eventually. It was impossible to believe that the dead children she had found had spent their whole lives in the dark. She crawled on and on, her fingers numb from striking the flint. At the end of one cramped fissure, The ceiling and the floor came together into a narrow slash in the rock. She crawled forward and pushed her head and arms into it. Then she struck her flint and nearly dropped it in awe. She did not notice the cavern, the spears of white that dropped from the ceiling, nor the folds in the rock where dead witches seemed to peer out at you. She saw only the blazing gold piled high to the ceiling, splendid as a bonfire. She struck again and again, and among the swords, the burnies, the goblets and the plate, the jewels and the coins taken in tribute from nightmare-tormented kings for 20 generations, she saw something far more precious, a fish oil lamp. It was quite a drop to the floor from where her tunnel came in, and she knew there would be no turning back once she had gone down. Adisla withdrew her head, wriggled round, and lowered herself down feet first, then dropped into blackness. Agony shot through her leg as she landed, and she let out a cry that echoed back at her. She had twisted her ankle, the same leg that the arrow had struck. Even as she held it, she could feel it begin to swell. No matter, she needed light. She struck the flint and crawled to where the lamp was. Her fingers curled around it, and she shook it. It was nearly full. Again she hit the flint. 5, maybe 6 tries, and she located what she was looking for. Something that would burn, a tattered cloak in some rich material she had never felt before. She found the edge of the cloak, teased off some threads, and struck the flint. Adisla had made a fire this way thousands of times at home, but now it seemed impossibly difficult. Her fingers were bleeding from catching them on the edge of the steel by the time an ember took. But then she had the lamp alight and looked around at the glory of the Witch Queen's hoard. Her fear did not subside as the dark shrank back, but it changed in nature. Before, the tunnels had seemed full of unseen eyes, invisible and hungry mouths. Now, in the silence of the huge cavern, she was afraid that she might be alone. Adisla realized that she might well die in these caves, witches or no witches. In some ways, to be alone was the worst monster of all. The gold was incredible, but, she realized, useless. She couldn't drink it, she couldn't eat it, and it almost mocked her. The pain in her ankle was growing. Was it sprained, or was it broken? There was a distant noise, a stirring like a breath, but much louder. She told herself it was the wind, but the air was still. She wanted to extinguish the light and hide, but knew that she had chosen to face whatever was in those tunnels. There it was again. What was it? Adisla's throat was dry, and she had to struggle with herself not to snuff out the lamp. Cold prickled her skin, and she began to shake. The lamp was guttering, or was that her imagination? Panic gripped her. Adisla scrambled up, but had forgotten her ankle. She screamed and fell to her knees, nearly dropping the lamp. The flame guttered and nearly died. She forced her hands to pick it up and held it high to look around. A terrible child stood over her, haggard, filthy, with the face of a woman and the eyes of the drowned. And then Adisla was calm. She realized that she had not seen the lady properly in the dark. This was no cave-dwelling hag. This was a queen. The lady extended her hand, and her kind smile told Adisla to forget about all pain, the anguish she felt for Vali, her desire to find Feleg, even the agony of her ankle. It would all be all right, thought Adisla. She knew that this lady had suffered torments beyond imagining, and could take all those that Adisla felt and wash them away. The lady was dressed in a fine robe embroidered with gold. A beautiful necklace burned at her throat, and a crown of sapphires shone like ice in the sun upon her head. Even the dark seemed to peel away around this lovely woman.
"I need you to help my Vali," said Adisla.
The lady smiled, and Adisla understood that she knew that, and was already working to free him. From the lady's demeanour, Adisla felt certain that even now Vali was on his way to meet her, and that soon everything would be settled. This lady had great powers, and could break any enchantment that Vali had suffered. Yes, everything was going to be all right. The lady had looked into her mind and sent her a vision to bring her peace. Adisla saw herself on a farmstead in the sun, children about her who ran giggling from old Bragi as he staggered around pretending to be a bear. There was someone else next to her, Felek or Vali, she couldn't be sure which. She felt secure, though, loving and loved among the people she valued most in all the world. The lady had shown her that future, and she was grateful to her. Adisla took the witch's hand, and Gulveig led her to the lower caves. Chapter 51 Reward. In the north, though the wind was a knife and the sky black with snow, Veleslibor was not cold, he was sweating. Underground, the wind didn't cut him and the snow didn't touch him. In the swaying torchlight, he pulled away the rocks. He would toil alongside the Norsemen, because he knew them well enough to realize that should he not do the work, some might think he was not worth a share of the reward. He knew that the hardest part would come if they found any treasure. Bodvar Bjarki owed him nothing. The crew owed him nothing, and they were not men of his king. So he had to rely on two things, his sharp wits and his companions' dim ones. Accordingly, he talked constantly of the robbing ways of southern merchants, and how one fine warrior had been tricked into giving half a dragon's hoard for a worthless belt that a merchant had claimed was that of the god Thor, capable of giving its owner a giant's strength. In truth, he hadn't really thought there would be any treasure, and had run out of ideas as to how he would pay Heming the ransom for the prince. However, anything was worth a go, and the crooked treasure mark and the great pile of stones looked very promising indeed. So he needed to make his companions see his worth.
"To get the best price for plunder, you need an experienced merchant on your side," he said. "When I think of all the proud warriors who have sold great treasures, never knowing what they had, it makes my heart weep. I tell you this, if I had that dragon's loot to sell, I would have got twice what it was worth. But then again I know where to find the buyers."
Some of the men were naive farm boys with little experience of anything, and they lapped up what Veles was saying. Bjarki, however, was a different matter. The berserk had to realize that if Veles got back to Heithabir with their plunder, Bjarki would never see so much as a bushel of oats in reward. However, Veles thought he could convince him that bargaining skills might be useful in a neutral port where Bjarki didn't have to fear the merchant's connections. Also, Bodvar Bjarki owed compensation. If he took anything but coin back to Forkbeard, the king would place his own value on it, which might leave the berserk with still more to pay. The merchant thought he'd use all these arguments when the time was right. The piled stones were finally clawed away, and they stood looking at a great flat slab. It had on it the same rune as the first rock they had removed, a jagged line with another through it.
"What does that mean?" said Bjarki.
"It is a curse," said Veles. "The treasure in here will need very careful handling if the men who take it are not to be struck down. In Byzantium, this sign was used to slay the emperor himself."
"Where is Byzantium?"
said one of the farm boys.
"He means Miklagard," said Bjarki.
"Where is Miklagard?" said the farm boy.
"West of here and down a little," said Veles. "Big town. Lots of sorcerers used to allaying curses. This did for them."
Bjarki snorted.
"I have my own way with curses," he said, and tapped his sword. "I've never met a sorcerer who can put his head back on when you've cut it off."
"Then you have never met the wizard Ptolemy. He is a friend of mine, and it is something of a party trick," said Veles.
The farm boys inclined their heads, impressed.
"I would like to test that trick," said Bjarki. "Perhaps I'll take you back in two pieces and see if he can stick you back together again."
Veles went quiet. He knew enough about human nature to see that Bjarki was quite capable of carrying out his threats. He didn't bother pointing out that, by the berserk's own account, he had been trapped by a sorcerer. Perhaps the death of the man who had enchanted him had made him bolder, or had the ridiculous wolf mask given him courage.
"Shall we get this done?" said one of the men. "I don't like this place. It grows crow food, and I have no desire to let it make a meal of me."
Bjarki nodded and went to the slab. He was a massive man, but his arms were not long enough to span the stone. He tried to get his fingers behind it, but it had jammed against the sloping end of the passage. Then he crouched and tugged at the rock at its front. He couldn't get the purchase to move it.
"Allow me," said Veles.
He took up one of the wooden wedges lying on the floor and hammered it with a stone into the crack between the slab and the passage wall. Then he sent a crewman down to the beach for water. The man came back, and Veles poured the water onto the wood.
"Do you hope to wash it away?" said one of the farm boys.
"Yes," said Veles.
After a few moments, the wood began to swell, and the gap between the wall and the slab widened. Bodvard Bjarki nodded, impressed, as Veles drove in more wedges.
"I am a magician in my own right, as you can see," said the merchant with a smile.
Eventually, the gap was big enough, and Bjarki stepped forward. He forced his hand in and pulled. Nothing happened. He spat and he swore, working himself up into a rage, mumbling under his breath,
"Odin, War Mary, Lord of Death, Odin, Destroyer, Wrecker, Mighty Slayer, Odin means frenzy, Odin means war, Odin, Odin, the mad, the half-blind, Odin, Odin, ah!"
The slab lifted. Bjarki heaved it into the vertical, where it teetered for a heartbeat, and seemed that it would fall back into place. But then it tipped towards him. Bjarki leapt back, and the stone followed him with a crash. There was a rush of stinking air from the hole in the cave floor, and even Veles, a man of iron stomach, found himself retching. Two crewmen had to turn aside to vomit. Even Bjarki recoiled, though he stepped forward again pretty quickly.
"It's a tomb," he said, "and a fresh one. You can smell the rot. Come on, lads, it's a good sign. No one's been here before us. Here's my freedom from my oath to Forkbeard."
He kneeled and secured a rope to a projection in the rock over the hole that seemed designed for the purpose.
"This is good," he said. "They've helped us out here, boys."
He grinned.
"Last one down's a pauper."
Then he lowered himself into the blackness. What was in that pit? Vali. No, not Vali. Something had Vali's thoughts, but they no longer defined its personality. They were loose and unconnected, shooting stars, here and then gone. His memories and experiences were pulp, running into each other, friendship and love no more important than the feel of the rock under his feet, the cold of the cave. At first he had accepted being in the pit because of his love for Adisla. He knew how near he had been to killing her, and though the sound of the slab sealing him in had filled him with despair, he had also welcomed it. While he was trapped, he could cause no more harm. When he'd seen the stricken Noaidi, his animal self had taken over, and he had accepted his fate for quite different reasons. He had food, the pit was sheltered. Why would he not want to be there? Then the food had run out, and he had beaten the walls with rage, leapt at the rock sealing him in, tried to dig his way out, and eventually, as any beast would, accepted his fate and sat down. By then, he could hardly remember who he was. His humanity seemed like a shoal of silver fish, turning and moving in the water, suddenly possessing shape and form, and then scattered to chaos by massive jaws. Velis was not far behind Bodvarbjarki. He cut his hands coming down the rope and cursed as he hit the rubble of the floor. Someone threw down a burning torch. Velis picked it up and peered around. He touched the wall. Something sticky was on his fingers. He licked at them and then wiped his tongue with his sleeve. It was blood. In front of him, Bjarki was edging forward, sword drawn.
"There are emeralds here," whispered the berserk. "Look, they're huge."
"Very likely cheap agate," said Velis. "I will need to value them properly."
But they weren't emeralds or agate. They were eyes. Chapter 52 King and Queen. The darkness was not the same as the last time, thought Orthon. On the way into the caves from the back of the mountain, the woman had taken flint, steel, and tinder, and a big bundle of candle stubs from a hole under a rock. She lit the candles, one off another, as they descended. But when one blew out, the darkness did not seem to cling too close, or to seethe with animosity and harm. The woman had prepared him before they went down, in her way. She had taken the wolf's head pebble that hung by a thong at her neck, and tied it around his neck.
"For luck," he said.
"Death," she said. He let her tie it. He felt no different, and as far as he could see, it was only a piece of stone. The king found it hard to credit that this entrance to the witch's caves was so easy to find. It was virtually signposted, a narrow crawl running into the side of the mountain, identified by sacrifices left at its mouth. The tunnel had the shape of a long-handled spoon, spreading into a tall chamber at its end. Access to the actual caves was through the roof of the tunnel, reached by stacking a pile of flat rocks and hooking down a rope with a stick. Anyone could have got in. The split in the cave roof was far from obvious, but Orthon wouldn't have trusted the entrance to stay hidden if the caves had been his refuge. It would only take a hunch from a curious warrior, and the enemy would be in. Why had he gone up the troll wall when this was available just on the other side? Orthon wondered if he was heading into a trap. He reminded himself that no one coming to those caves would see anything the witches didn't want him to see. So, were they allowing him in? He had looked at the uncollected sacrifices at the entrance. Bottles and pots, anything that couldn't be taken by animals. Were the witches even there? Still, he wasn't scared. Certain of death and welcoming it, there was no room for terror in his life. So, the bodies of the boys, the rat-eaten corpses of the girls, the puffy flesh of the drowned women in the ponds, and the rotting, blackened faces of those who hung by ropes from spars of rock, only caused him the discomfort of remembering how many people he had sent to similar fates. The constriction of the tunnels, however, was another matter. Orthon was not afraid of death, but he had no desire to suffocate. His own arms sealing his mouth and nose in a tight gullet of rock. Some of the passages were scarcely wider than his head, and he had to squirm and wriggle his way through. He began to see why this entrance was not so well guarded as the others on the troll wall side of the caves. An enemy coming in this way would be hugely vulnerable. A warrior can't fight with his arms pinned above his head. So the route was easy in some ways, but at the same time very tricky. Even without the witches sending their nightmares stalking through the passageways. As he descended, he became more and more sure the witches were dead. How could he have held on to his sanity so long in those tunnels if they hadn't been? What had killed them? They rested by the light of a candle by an underground pool. The pool caught the reflection of the ceiling in the candlelight, turning it into a shimmering golden disc. He looked at Saitada. Had this woman become a witch? Was she now their servant, and was he there to kill whatever had caused so many deaths in the tunnels? He put the thoughts aside. They were no good to him. He would just concentrate on what he would do. Act, as always. Do and kill until he himself was killed. He wanted no more murders, but when the fight presented itself, he would not shirk from it. He knew no other way. After what he thought must have been a day in the caves, he became aware of a soft glow answering the light of their candle from down the tunnel. He looked at the woman and put his hand to his sword. She shook her head, which he took for an assurance of safety. Drawing quietly closer, he realized that the light was a reflection of their own candle from a mass of gold. Weapons, armor, rings, and jewels were piled to the ceiling like a miser's dream. It was said the witches had collected tribute and plunder for 1,000 years. It seemed too short a time to collect such a hoard. "How many have died to reach here?" he said, as much to himself as to the woman, and then almost laughed. For most of his life he would have rejoiced in this, taken all he could and returned in glory. Not now. He hardly understood the purpose of riches any more. Jewels were called the Tears of Freya, after the goddess who was said to weep them. He had thought it just a story for winter, but now he saw that tears and precious things have their fates tightly bound. He touched a burnie and a shield. Both were dull with age, but very finely made and in good repair. The woman shook her head. She meant, he thought, that he would not need them for the battle he was to face. Something, though, intuition or just the desire to die as he had lived in war gear, came over him. In all his lonely meditations and nightmares of regret, some simple warrior's habits had proved unshakable. In an uncertain situation, he would take whatever advantage he could. He put on the burnie, found a gilded iron helmet to fit him, and took up a splendid shield that bore the sign not of the wolf, but of the raven, Odin's sign. Saitada set her candle on the floor, sat on the most comfortable stone she could find, and watched him dress. She said that word again under her breath. Death. There was movement in the mouth of a tunnel. Orphan's sword was out, liquid in the candlelight. There was another movement in a tunnel to his left. Then she was in front of him, not 3 paces away. It was a girl. A wasted and haggard child, dressed in a long and bloody white shift. In her hand was a broken spear shaft, the end burned in a fire until it was a wicked, tapering shard, a blackened needle. Orthon had only ever seen her face 2 times before, and then only in glimpses. But he recognized her. She was thinner and madder and starved and white, but he recognized her. The necklace at her throat burned with all the colors of war. She was the Witch Queen.
Lady, said Orthon.
Death, said Sitada, pointing to the child. The candle went out. There was a noise from somewhere deep in the caves. It spoke to Orthon's body rather than his mind, pulling the skin into bumps on his arms and neck, drying his mouth and making his heart pump. It was fear given sound, the howl of a wolf. The witch spoke. Her voice was hardly audible, cracked and weak.
Odin.
Sitada struck a flint, and Orthon saw in the flash that the queen was gone. Sitada struck again, but could not make the tinder catch.
Odin.
Sitada struck a third time, and the witch was on him, driving the spear towards his head, but Orthon caught it in one hand. The witch had no strength in her child's arms. Orthon reversed the thrust and smashed the butt of the spear into her eye. She shrieked, and it was dark again. Orthon couldn't understand why she had thought to attack him this way. She could boil a sleeping man's brains 5 days' travel away. Why fight him like this? Then he thought of the amulet at his neck. Protection against magic was, after all, what they were for.
Get me light, girl! Strike that flint!
Then something hit him like an avalanche. Chapter 53. The Battle in the Horde Cave. Felek had cursed himself for his inability to dive into the tunnel. It wasn't a matter of bravery. He simply couldn't do it. Like, he couldn't fly. His limbs wouldn't obey his commands. His attempts to push himself down into the pool only met with choking frustration. Adisla had gone, and his mind was in a terrible confusion. All he wanted had been his in the fleeting moment of her kiss. He wished that she could have just walked with him off that mountain and gone to his home in the hills, instead of plunging into the pool. She had gone to meet the witches, to rescue the prince. He had no other course of action. He loved her, so he had to help her. He waited for her to come back. It got dark. When it became light, he tried again. Useless. His body would not do as he told it. He searched the mountain for an entrance in increasing desperation. In a bowl of rock above a dizzying drop, there was a cave that looked promising, long and narrow, with sacrifices at the mouth. But when he went inside, there was the smell of humans, but no sign of an entrance. Besides, the ceiling looked dangerously split. He thought it might fall at any instant, so he went back outside. He ran all over the mountain, looking for anything that resembled a way in. There was no alternative, he decided. He would have to try the wall. He knew the entrances there were easier to spot, but also that they were almost impossible to get to. He climbed to the top of the great cliff, up to a knife-edge ridge, on which strange tall outcrops of rocks, like the fingers of a monstrous hand stretching for the sky, loomed above him. These were the trolls that gave the wall its name, rumored to have been turned to stone, looking at the beauty of the sunrise. He looked out over the land. He was so high up that it would take him, he thought, 20 heartbeats to hit the ground if he fell. Clouds drifted by beneath him. The route he had followed to reach this point was threatening enough. The overhang below him was almost unimaginable, but he had to try. He lowered himself, kicking his legs into the vast space below him, his feet feeling for a shelf, a hold. But, as in the pool, his body took over, and he pulled himself up. He sat in the freezing wind on the edge of the wall, hating himself for his cowardice. Then he saw something down on the plain. There were 2 travelers, far below. He would have ignored them, but then he heard something he had never heard before. It was a howl of pain, a thin blade of sound that seemed to quiver not in the air, but in his head. He knew who it was. Adisla, calling to him to help her. He saw a vision of that jagged rune on the sorcerer's stone and felt a pull like a riptide impelling him on. Felix, to whom the language of the wolves was as plain as speaking, knew what the howl had said. I am in agony. He had to get to her. Perhaps the travellers below would know an entrance to the caves. It was an idea born of desperation rather than good sense. He watched them move around the wall, and when he was sure of their route along a ravine, he set off to meet them. Then doubts crept in. How long had he haunted these lands as a wolf, smashing and tearing and taking what he wanted? His experiences since the prince had captured him had made him forget who he was. These people would see him as a wild animal and very likely flee. He decided to follow them at a distance and watch for a time before approaching. Still, he would have to be quick. He descended the mountain in swift, silent leaps. He followed them from the top of the ravine around to the back of the mountain. At first he thought they were beggars. The woman was dressed in rags and the man no better. Only the curved sword that the man carried in his hands said that they were people of a different station altogether. Felix, who had no real appreciation of gold or jewellery, was still dazzled by the magnificence of the scabbard, catching the winter sun in white flashes. He decided to wait until night, take the man's sword while he was sleeping, then he could bargain it back for information. But they did not stop to make camp, travelling on as the sun weakened to a smoky dusk. Eventually, they came to the long cave that Felix had already inspected. He followed them inside, using all his hunter's stealth, and watched as the woman piled flat slabs one on top of another. Then she reached up with a stick and fished something from the crack in the cave's ceiling. It was a knotted rope, and she began to climb it. Felix felt like running forward, pulling her out of the way and climbing the rope into the dark, but had noticed the bearing of the white-haired man. He was old, but he was strong. The wolfman was confident he could take him in a fight, but saw no point. And the woman? Felix knew the sisters never left the darkness, so she wasn't a witch. However, she seemed to know the caves, and might lead him where he needed to go. So he watched. The man held a candle while she climbed, then she lit another at the top, and he went up. The rope was then pulled up and the light faded. Felix gave it as little time as he dared, grabbed the stick and leapt up onto the pile of rocks. He poked around above him with the stick until he snagged the rope and tugged it free. Then he pulled himself up into the dark. Something else was under his hand. It was a pole, and he guessed it would be used to knock over the pile of rocks and cover the tracks of anyone entering the cave. He left it where it was. After a steep climb, he came to where the rope was fastened. Here, the fissure sloped into a level tunnel. There was no light at first, but a wolf is a creature of smell, not sight. The human musk and the fish stink of the candle led him on until, faintly, he saw a glow. He followed the trail down through the tunnels and the cracks, trusting to the scents when he couldn't see a light. Felix knew his chances of finding Adisla in that labyrinth were very small indeed, but these two were his only hope. He didn't know where they were going, but they were going somewhere and they had light. That had to be better than crawling purposelessly through the dark. As he descended, Felix began to feel there was something else in the darkness, something that didn't wish him well. He had no wolf stone to protect him, no gift from a god to keep him safe. The dark seemed like an animal itself, one that rubbed against him, licked his flesh, knew him even. Something, Felix sensed, was crawling over his mind, sniffing at his thoughts, marking them with its own scent. The witch, he could tell, knew he was there. On instinct, he tried to lose himself, to cut away that human part, to just be a wolf hunting in the dark, as Kveldulf had taught him to be. He felt the pressure in his head lift and move away. She had gone, but he knew that to get what Adisla wanted, to bring back the prince, he would have to confront the witch face to face. Even at a distance, her presence had seemed like a spider creeping over his brain. Felix was sweating now. The candlelight had stopped moving forwards. As he drew nearer, it became stronger, its glow more golden. He edged his way to a corner and looked round. The old man with the sword was standing in front of what seemed to be a hill of gold. The treasure was piled from the floor to the ceiling of the cavern, and the chamber was not low. The man had put on a burnie and a helmet, and was holding a shield that seemed more for show than war. Felix looked at the way the man stood in his war gear, the confidence that seemed to shine from him. He knew this would be no easy opponent, no merchant's bodyguard to be smashed and dashed. In front of the old warrior was a child, a haggard girl in a dirty, bloody shift, carrying a broken spear shaft. Then the light had gone. In the flash of a flint being struck, Felix saw the man and his companion, but the girl had vanished. Another flash, and another, and the girl was there, stabbing at the warrior with her spear shaft. Felix saw her fall, and then it was dark again. And Felix knew. The ragged little girl was the witch, and the only hope for the prince Adisla loved. If the warrior was attacking her, that made him his enemy. It was flat dark, but Felix could hear the man breathing, smell his sweat, hear the movement of the rings on the burnie. Quiet as a wolf over snow, he sped towards him and struck. Anyone Felix had ever faced had been put down by his first attack, and Orthon was no different. The king went sprawling to the floor with Felix on top of him, but even as he hit Orthon, Felix knew he was in a fight. There was no fatal breath of shock for the king, no moment where he needed to work out what had happened to him and adjust. In an instant, he had locked out the arm Felix had put to his throat, driven into the elbow joint with the heel of his hand, and forced the wolfman off him, twisting to stand as he did so. All that without sight. If Felix had been a less flexible man, Orthon would have had him at his mercy, using his arm to pinion him through the shoulder to the floor. Instead, Felix rolled away and broke Orthon's grip. But now the momentum of the fight had changed. Orthon was standing, Felix was on the floor, barrel rolling away from him. Felix felt the king's shin in his side as Orthon kept pace with him. The warrior was keeping contact with him so as not to lose him in the dark. Felix flipped back and heard the sword cut the air. Felix was now on his feet. The king's burnie jingled like a reindeer sled as he moved and told Felix exactly where he was. The wolfman sprang again. The king could not see him but heard him exhale as he leapt. Orthon crouched behind his shield to offer a smaller target, and the wolfman went over his head, falling badly on the uneven floor. There was a mournful sound from far away, like the mountain wind, though they were too far underground to be able to hear that. All the air had been driven out of Felix's lungs by his fall, and Orthon moved towards him, drawn by the sound of his panting. The noise again. It couldn't be wind. Not here. And it sounded more animal. Orthon struck into the darkness, but his sword sparked on the floor. There was another flash. Saitada was trying desperately to light a candle. In the instant of light, he saw the wolfman about to spring. Felix hit him again, but Orthon blocked with his shield and bounced him aside. Orthon could sense his man was tiring. He wished he had a shorter weapon than the moonsword with him. If he let the wolfman close with him, he could finish him at close range with a knife. The flint hit steel once more, and Orthon caught a glimpse of his opponent. It was enough. The moonsword sliced out and caught the advancing Feleg across the thigh. The wolfman screamed as he crashed into Orthon. The king battered him down with his shield. Feleg was howling, but a deeper sound stopped Orthon dead. A rumbling snarl like a rock slide. It was a very large animal, probably a bear, and it was close. The noise distracted the king, and the wolfman rolled away. Feleg couldn't stand. That much was clear to Orthon, who could hear him dragging himself away in the dark. With another enemy so close, Orthon couldn't risk grubbing about to finish him off. But he knew men in battle could get up from terrible wounds, and Feleg's groans gave him away. However, the wounded wolfman was useful to the king. If there was a bear in the cave, it would be drawn to the coughing and groaning man on the floor. Then Orthon would know where both his opponents were. Finally, Sitada had the candle lit. The wolfman was trying to get up, while behind him floated two points of green light. When Orthon's eyes adjusted, he felt himself shiver. It was a wolf, but bigger than any wolf he had ever seen. It was bigger than any man, half again bigger than any white bear. How had it got into the caves? The tunnels were surely too narrow. The creature snapped its jaws and looked at him, coughing and hacking.
Fath!
If Orthon had not known better, he would have said the beast was trying to speak. He made himself loosen his grip on the moonsword, shook the tension from his limbs, breathed out, and walked towards the wolf. To his right, Orthon noticed the wolfman crawling away. Let him go, he thought. He would be dead from loss of blood before long, and even if he survived, wouldn't be back to attack him any time soon. The fury that allows a man to forget mortal wounds is a short-lived thing, Orthon knew. 5 paces from the creature, he stopped. He was struck that its front right limb was more like a human arm than the foreleg of a wolf, but most of all he noticed its teeth, each as big as a boat nail. The king smiled. This was a rare death, he thought. One worthy of the tales of the skalds, but there was only the scarred woman there to witness it. He almost wished he hadn't mortally wounded his previous opponent. His old friend Varin would have loved to have died fighting such a monster, he thought. The face of the drowned man came into his mind again. He had killed him, and for what? What had been made by his ambition? What future secured? What treasures won? The beast hacked and coughed again. Was it trying to speak? It didn't matter. Orthon had wanted death, and here was his perfect enemy. The opponent who could not be pitied. The monster, the useful fiend, who could be struck without compunction. Orthon raised the moonsword. It was as if the animal caught his intent the instant it arose in the king. It snarled forward in a blur, knocking him to the floor. The Birnie saved his back on the rough stone, but the wind was knocked from him. Orthon could not let that concern him. Feleg bit down his agony and watched in the flickering candlelight as the king rolled away from the beast's jaws, wriggling underneath it to slash up with his sword. The wolf was cut, its blood splashing onto Orthon's face. The creature howled and leapt away from Orthon, but did not take long to recover. It charged again, but this time swiped at the king's sword arm with its man-like arm. Orthon had been ready to duck the charge, but the attack on his weapon surprised him. He'd expect that from a man, but not an animal. There was a clatter as the moonsword went flashing across the cave. For the first time in his life, Orthon had been disarmed in battle. Now the fight really started, the wolf driving into the king with tooth and claw, the king turning and ducking, dodging and jumping, and, when that failed, catching the attacks on his shield. Even through his pain, Felag had to admire the old warrior. Though empty-handed and fighting such an enemy, he didn't lose his head. All the time, as he slipped past the creature's attacks or rolled and twisted away, he was working his way towards where his sword lay. Felag had to wonder why the warrior's companion didn't help him. The woman just sat in the candle glow, calm as if she was listening to a story by the fire. The king was getting close to his sword. He was unharmed, though the animal had torn holes in his byrnie and ripped his shield to splinters. Felag summoned his strength and crawled forward. The battle was almost on top of him, the old warrior crouching to feel for his sword. Felag put his hand on the moonsword, picked it up, and dragged himself away into the shadows. Orthon did not pause. He simply readjusted his retreat, giving ground with each one of the wolf's attacks, back towards the hoard of gold and the weapons that lay within it. Felag pulled himself to his feet and limped towards the nearest tunnel. Pushing himself along the wall of the passage, he made his way into the darkness, the sounds of the fight fading in his ears. He felt his way down and down. The tunnel seemed endless, but he couldn't afford to rest. He drove himself on, away from the old warrior, away from the teeth of the wolf, and after some time had the sense that he was in a larger cave. Then he heard something. A whimper. It was some distance away, and for a moment he dared to think it was a Deesler. He ran his hand across the wall of the cave and limped on, clutching his wounded thigh with one hand, the moonsword pressed under his other arm. The wall opened into another corridor. It was small, mercifully small, not much wider than a man. The beast would not be able to get down there. From below, he heard the voice again.
"Help me!"
His stomach leapt. It was a Deesler. He pushed himself on, the going terribly hard on the uneven floor.
"Help me!"
The voice was louder now. Yes, no mistake, it was her. Around a curve in the tunnel, he could see a light. Chapter 54. Tracking. The creature was hungry. The need to eat saturated his mind as the first light appeared, like the nimbus of the sun from behind a rain cloud, at the edge of the great slab that sealed him in. But he had not lost his animal caution, and watched from the darkness to see what it was that had freed him. Wolves do not rush in until they know the odds, and the creature, who only had a weak notion of his invulnerability, wanted to see his opponents before striking. But then they had come down into the pit, and other beast feelings had taken over. If an animal stays somewhere long enough, it regards that place as its den. The creature felt threatened. He heard words he didn't really understand.
"Let me go first. This treasure may be delicate, and I should assess how best to move it."
"We're taking everything from this tomb, merchant. Do not make me leave your body in payment."
There was no idea of revenge in the wolf's brain as he snapped off Bodvar Bjarki's head. Only hunger. There was only hunger, too, as he watched Veles trying in vain to climb the rope out of the pit. He closed on him, ripped open his back with a single bite, gulped down a gob of meat, poured him to the floor, and tore away the flesh from his belly, sucking on his sweet entrails as the merchant screamed. Vali might have been pleased to see Veles suffer for what he had done to him, or might have thought that it was too strong a punishment for the crime he had committed, but he was scarcely there inside the wolf to have feelings either way. He was not one thing any more. He was a crowd, a mob, each of its members screaming for attention. The sorcerer, the whale people, the family of reindeer hunters, the pirate Danes were all in him. Or rather, he was them, his consciousness a wild jumble of digested thoughts and personalities. His mind was like a marketplace, each bidder yabbering to stake his claim. Above them all, though, was the keening voice of the wolf, providing direction, impelling his body to action. Panic flooded down from above. Men were scrambling to replace the great slab of rock that had sealed him in, but no one could shift it. They gave up and ran. The wolf was out of the pit in a bound. There were things in his way, things that yelled and beat at him, so he swept them aside, cracked them in his jaws, allowed their juices and ichors to calm the hunger of his long incarceration. When they were all dead, he lay down, heavy with what he had eaten, his brain torpid, his body growing as it put its meal to work under the frozen moon and the green fire skies of the winter's unyielding dark. He was not Vali. His body was like a twisted musical instrument, and the prince was a tune it could play, but it did not then, nor for a while. Not until he heard her cry the agonized howl that called him to life inside the beast. In the lowest cave of the troll wall, it appeared to Adisla that she lay on a wonderful bed of straw covered with luxurious furs. She was back in her house. Her mother was there, and Barth the Dane, Manni, and all her brothers. The calm that had come down upon her with the lady's presence seemed like the snugness of her bed on a winter's morning. Adisla knew the witch queen wanted her to call Vali. Adisla spoke his name. The witch looked into her eyes and stroked her hair. She wanted Adisla to repeat the name she could tell, and she did so gladly after all the lady's kindnesses. The witch queen looked down at Adisla and nodded to herself. She had been trying to work through the girl, to channel Adisla's tender thoughts in order to send them to the wolf and summon him. That, it appeared, was not going to work. Gulveig allowed the barbed rune to surface in her mind. It made her shiver. Its presence felt almost toxic, as though if she held it too long it would burn her, destroy her even. Then she sent it to the mind of the girl before her. Adisla screamed as her illusion fell away. She was not in her bed at all. There was no house, no loving family around her. She was pinioned on a narrow wedge of sharp stones at the end of a tapering cave. The stones cut her, and the weird light of oil lamps cast shadows that seemed like long, cruel fingers reaching out to tear her flesh. She was in agony. As the rune spilled from the witch's mind, Adisla saw what was intended. She saw visions of death. Hers and Vali's, Felix and Bragi's, in that life and in others, stretching away into time. And she saw what the witch herself didn't see. She saw Gulveig's true name, and that knowledge was more terrible than the bonds that tied her down, more terrible than the sharp rocks that cut her, more terrible even than Vali, transformed and murderous. Adisla knew that the lady wanted her to call Vali, and now she knew why.
"I will not," she said.
Someone came into view. It wasn't the lady, but a pale and terrible child with an aged face. The witch queen opened her mind, and it was as if all the ghosts and dreads that Adisla carried with her rose up to engulf her and drag her down. She saw her mother dying, Manni dead at the door, Vali slavering and grunting in that pit. Desperate to stop these nightmares swamping her, Adisla needed something to cling to blot out the vile images. The rune, shimmering and twisting in front of her, was her salvation, she thought, though she didn't know where that idea came from. She stared into it, focused on it,